Hello and welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. On this podcast, we feature a keynote speech from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Enterprise Information and Technology Conference. Our speaker is Richard Katz, Vice President for EDUCAUSE. And the speech is entitled, The Tower and the Cloud, Higher Education in the Age of Cloud Computing.
Thank you very much. I hope I'm not going to disappoint you today, because in characteristic Richard form, the title of the session will raise certain levels of hopes and expectations, and I, of course, will plan to do something quite a bit different. I'm not going to talk to you per se about cloud computing, even though I know that that's one of the most pressing, important, and overhyped topics of the day. We can talk about it. The title is the title. The books are available, I'm told, for the asking. There's a lot in the book about cloud computing as a technical issue, as a governance issue, as a policy issue. But what I'm going to be talking to you about is really the implications of cloud computing. And it's really more than cloud computing, because I'm thinking of cloud as the very fabric of services that are being delivered increasingly over networks through virtualization and a whole host of technologies you've been involved in implementing. To me, there's a whole interesting and rich body of knowledge, literature, and practice evolving around the cloud computing space. I think that you probably have access to most of that. What's really interesting to me are the shifts that are going on, and in particular, the power shifts that are going on. Cloud computing, in my mind, or this next step in the evolution, and I do think that's an evolutionary step in technology and in our practice, is actually going to promote a revolutionary or transformational shift in higher education. And it's just a sort of simple way that I've managed to think about this is, if you think about the history of higher education, which is now about 1,000 years old, the first universities were chartered by popes. So I think of our history as going from popes to then it was princes, to prelates or priests, to professors. And look how much the professors and the priests look alike. To the people. So it's this sort of five piece. I didn't really know how to represent the people in the slide. I thought of, you know, socialist realist paintings or whatever, but this one sort of crossed my radar. But this is really what we're witnessing here, is a tremendous shift, and you can look at it in political terms with the inauguration of the Obama administration. You can look at every facet of life. We're looking at the popularization, the empowerment of people like us to take responsibility through the internet and through the resources on the internet for every aspect of our lives, including our higher educations. So I'm going to, I don't know if you paid attention to, so there's the title of the talk. It's really the subtitle, I think, that's more fun here. I'm hoping to go through this pretty quickly so that we can have a dialogue. I really think that this is much more a philosophical talk. It is much more a political talk than it is a technical talk. And the real question is, can we as information technology leaders and professionals lead a new discussion on our campuses? Because what I'm afraid is that in our rush of daily lives, in our propensity to deal with the urgent and the technical, that we will know that, in fact, this transformational potential exists in what we are doing for our institutions, but that we will somehow miss the opportunity to really educate, energize, and mobilize our colleagues in the leadership of the institution to these possibilities. And I think that that would be putting the institution and ourselves thereby at great peril. So let's start by, I'm going to throw out a variety of questions here to ask, you know, what do you believe? I think at the heart of this discussion is the question of what is our fundamental belief about the information technology that we're responsible for. I think one of the poles, if you will, in a discussion about what we believe is that represented on this slide by Stanley Katz, who is a professor at Princeton University and former president of the American Council of Learned Societies. And Katz basically argues, and he is no relative, that information technology is a tool. It is not something that happens to us. It is something that we create. We control it. We're in charge, right? Contrast Katz's argument with that of Martin Trow. Marty was one of my faculty mentors at Berkeley, a very eminent sociologist, one of the great thinkers about higher education, a contemporary and colleague of Clark Kerr's. Very different idea about information technology. Trow argues that information technology is like a raging torrent of water moving down a hill that sweeps away everything in its path, cutting its own channel, leading potentially to the creation of new institutions that differ from those of today. That's a very different argument than this is a tool that we control. We don't control, as the people here in New Orleans know too well, raging torrents of water. And this I am related to. This is the Richard Katz view. It's a bit of a synthesis of the two. And that is, I believe that the history of technology in many ways is a history of accidental revolutions, and that we are very much, for those of you who are fans of Ray Kurzweil, like the frog that's been placed in the pot of cold water and slowly heated up. As you know that story, that if you put a frog in boiling water, it will, of course, jump out. If you put a frog in room temperature water and then heat it up slowly, the frog will stay there until it's cooked. And I worry a little bit that that we are the frog and that the water is being heated up around us. And the question that I want to maybe have you carry with you throughout the next day and a half is, how warm and comfortable is the water? Probably doesn't feel warm and comfortable right now. Maybe it's actually getting to that point in a hot tub where you're thinking, I better get out of here. I'm not going to spend much time at all, but we are in a period of great shifts in higher education. You don't need me to tell you just how tough the economic dislocations of the last 6 to 12 months have been. How intense you expect them to be over the period of whatever it is, 6, 12, 18, 24 months. The demographic shifts that are going on are even more interesting to me. For those of you who follow those kinds of things, I have read some writers that anticipate that by the year 2050, the population of Japan will drop by 50%. I mean, these are remarkable phenomena. The population of France is expected to drop by 25% in the next 20 years. We're going to see widespread exodus from the workforce on the part of baby boomers like me, maybe like a couple of you. So it's a remarkable story of demographic change, economic change, enrollments, which have grown pretty much in every region of North America over the past 25 years, depending, again, where in North America you are. They're expected to decline about the year 2011. Well, gee, that's only a couple years away. So we're going to start to see increasing pressures on enrollments. There is something that we in the U.S. talk about as an affordability crisis, so the cost of producing a higher education is increasingly problematic. And there is, we dodged a bullet, and again in the U.S. last year, with something called the Spellings Commission, that's only one shot across the bow. And many of you operate in public universities in states where the accountability language is already in place. So there's an increasing pressure on all of us, private universities, public universities, to account for our performance, to account for the success of our students, to account for the time and outputs of our faculty, and so forth. There's also increasing democratization of access to the university and to its resources. I think this is, again, part of that transition, that devolution, that empowerment I talked about earlier. There is an increasing, and I think this will be the topic of the next 10 to 15 years, increasing competition for talent, both students, faculty, and for staff. Most of us can remember 10 years ago when we were competing like crazy for IT workers. This was the dot-com boom. We sort of got over that, but interestingly enough, employment in the IT sector is now at the same level that it was at the height of the dot-com boom. So in spite of the flattening of the world, the accessibility of computational resources in the form of programmers, program administrators, and so forth in India, China, and elsewhere, we're going to have tremendous competition for IT professionals. We're going to have even greater competition for talented faculty in the next 15, 20 years. The next 10 years is expected to be the largest exodus from the workforce of faculty in the history of higher education. So it's just going to be remarkably difficult to attract faculty. I met a man recently who is the representative of the government of Singapore, whose job it is to attract important, influential life scientists to that island country where they have built this science city that is just an extraordinary multi-billion-dollar endeavor. This guy gets paid $2 to $3 million a year to fly around the country and poach your faculty. I mean, he's just going around, familiar with the scientific literature, and he understands that the future of Singapore is in intellectual capital management and development, which is in turn dependent on talent management and development. And the nation of Singapore pays this guy $2 to $3 million a year. He's a talent agent and a talent scout. So we are going to see this increasingly in the academic enterprise. On a very, very positive note, it is increasingly and abundantly evident that higher education is that gateway. It is the ticket, the cost of admission to the wealth of nations, to increasing social mobility of our citizenry. And so another question that I'd like to plant with you, and again, if I plant a question and you go, I have the answer, or I have a counter question, please raise it. But does all of this equate to the rising importance of higher education? The unasked question that I have is, does that in turn equate to the rising importance of colleges and universities? I think they're two different questions, because we really are talking about virtualization. We really are asking questions about the meaning of place and the meaning of institution. So let's talk for a minute. We'll shift and talk about cloud as I define it, which is not cloud in the very narrow technical sense that cloud computing is being talked about. But let's talk about what we have wrought, and higher education really has been integral to the development of computing and communications in the world to date. But we're seeing, obviously, the blinding improvement in price performance of everything, computers, networks, storage, and so forth. I think the latest count is 1.3 billion Earthlings are now persistently connected to the internet. It's a remarkable thing. There is fairly widespread, not yet ubiquitous, but pretty darn widespread broadband access. And most content on the planet is now digital. I mean, this is all in 45, 50 years. the network really has, you know, how many years has Sun said, you know, the network is the computer. It really is the computer. You know, we have seen, you are all living with the consequences of the emergence of the next generation of students. Many of us are parents of those next generation of students. Very different. They know how to tweet a talk. They don't have to be given a primer and an infrastructure. They're just doing this stuff. Web 2.0 really is a social movement. It is not a technical movement. I'm mindful of that famous quote of Mohandas Gandhi, which is the one that is, "There go my people. I must hurry and catch up with them because I am their leader." I mean, do most of us feel that way most of the time, that with the young people on our campuses, we are, you know, running to catch up in order to lead the parade? And there is a real, real revolution that information technology and communications technologies have led, particularly in the scientific research arena. So the questions that I hope, again, will pervade your conversations, I hope we'll get a chance to talk here, but over the next day and a half, is how will the internet cloud grow to envelop the university? I mean, that's the premise of the Tower and the Cloud book, is that, you know, what we have is an institution that's existed in more or less recognizable form continuously for 1,000 years. You have this thing called the cloud, which is a cluster of services surrounding communications and computation that we have evolved over the course of 60 years. This cloud is getting bigger, and it's coming very much to encompass our towers. The question is, how is it going to envelop us? How is the university using the cloud to extend its presence? I mean, can we use the cloud to extend the footprint and impact of our institutions? And the question that really fascinates me the most is, how does cloudiness alter the form of our social institutions? And imagine yourself, how many of you saw the Colbert Report recently, where he was interviewing the head of, what was it, the Newspaper Association of America, which is I mean, he is sitting there with the president of the Newspaper Association of America. Most of you didn't see it, it sounds like. Go on the web, go to YouTube, just watch it. It's very funny. It's 5 minutes long. But among the shticks that he pulled is to ask this guy, he goes, "Knock, knock." The guy goes, "Who's there?" "The death of newspapers." The guy goes, "No, that's not there." I mean, do we need to be talking about, knock, knock, who's there, the death of libraries? Knock, knock, who's there, the death of IT, enterprise IT? Knock, knock, who's there, the death of universities? I mean, the very fate of our social institutions, I do believe, is on the line. I mean, I don't think it's as dire as that. But I think that if we don't look at the newspaper industry and we don't sort of ask the questions, you know, are we just in a pond that is a few degrees cooler than the pond that the newspapers are sitting in? What does it mean that we are empowering people to take responsibility and to have the means to execute that responsibility for their own higher education? What does it mean that we are opening access to course content, to academic expertise, to the expertise of amateurs, in a world where traditionally we have controlled all of those assets on things called college campuses? And I've now managed to freeze up my computer. I apologize for that. Okay, so I've been alluding to a shifting balance of power. I mean, this is really absolutely, you know, when I was preparing this talk, and I wanted to get an image of professors, I go to Google in fashion I do and just put professors and hit. You know what the top entry on the page when you Google professors? It's ratemyprofessors.com. Now, if anything, symbolizes the shift in power. I mean, it used to be, and some of you have heard me before, I mean, my background academically is as an historian, and I'm fascinated with the history of higher education. And back in the day, that is around 850 AD, in places like England, there were no campuses, there were no universities, there were only students who would pool their money together in the form of a student guild or union, which is the remote origins of that institution, and they would then bring itinerant roving bands of scholars to them for the purpose of educating them. Obviously, the locus of power, the center of power, shifted around the year 1100 with the creation of the first site-based institutions of higher learning. The question is, as our technologies make it increasingly easy to virtualize, Cynthia talked about, we're going to virtualize this meeting. What are the implications of virtualizing an EDUCAUSE conference for EDUCAUSE? We don't know yet. We're going to go that way because that's the way the world is going, because in many ways you are demanding that. The same is true for our colleges and universities. Enrollment growth in distance education in these troubled times financially is off the scale. I just got a note, you know, on the same day from a colleague at the Colorado Community Colleges saying things are really horrible. We're getting cut here and here and here. That very day, I got a note from a colleague at the Colorado Community College System who said, gosh, our distance education arm, which I'm responsible for, is now up to $25 million in sales. So, you know, are we seeing those lines cross where, in fact, enrollment in virtual kinds of offerings are going to start to exceed enrollments in traditional face-to-face? Another gigantic trend, I think, is rising consumerism. This is one that I'm deeply interested in, a little bit troubled by. But increasingly, higher education has become a consumer good. We've all heard of helicopter parents, probably a little too closely and personally. Robert Strauss, who wrote a great book on generation, who is now passed away, gave a talk at an ECAR seminar where he said, well, if you think helicopter parents are bad, the next generation, which is the generation that now has their kids in college, the X generation, he called them fighter bombers. So if helicopter parents hovered and made gentle inquiries, the fighter bombers are going to be in our face. The rise of truthiness. This is another you can see. Stephen Colbert has influenced my thinking quite a bit, but in fact, the idea of truthiness is not his originally. But there's a real question about social fragmentation on the internet, the nature of truth. Is the fact that your blog is posted more often than mine make yours more truthful information, more reliable information, more accurate information? I mean, the real place in our society for the kind of scholarly literacies and values that the university and college has embodied for 1,000 years is really under challenge in many ways in the popularization of information and popularization of learning and culture on the internet. Along with this is the emergence of the collective, the so-called wisdom of crowds. Again, you know, are crowds wise or not? I mean, this is something that is not well understood empirically. Many of us have no doubt done the sort of Air Force survival courses where we've seen that in general, the results of group discussions are overall better than the results of individual efforts in the same direction. but the question of whether or not crowds are wise and how, in fact, we embrace and include them is an open question. And even more, the question for us as administrators at universities is how the wisdom of crowds comports with our own notion as gatekeepers. I've been rereading the very influential book by Clark Curran a few years ago, where he described and made a very passionate and I think at the time correct argument of the university faculty as gatekeepers, those who are controlling access of students and learning and mediating that. That whole self-conceptualization of academics as knowledge gatekeepers, which is a conceptualization I think that goes back 1,000 years, really flies in the face of what we've created in terms of technology and the information environment on the internet. So we do get back in many ways, I think, to the argument that Ray Kurzweil makes. You know, he has his great line, which is exponential growth looks like nothing is happening until it explodes. So again, are we the frog sitting in the pond feeling relatively warm now? Might have been comfortable 5 years ago, getting warm now. At what point do we reach the inflection point where things take off, where we begin to be the butt of the knock-knock jokes, where the answer is not newspapers, it's universities? And what this leads me to is a number of conundrums. I have a dear friend who was vice chancellor of Thames Valley University in England, and he made the point that being a university president means a sentence to spending your career managing contradictions. And the more I've been around and the more I think about things, the more I think that we are in the business, particularly those of us in information technology in educational settings, we're facing contradictions all the time. So contradiction number one, we live in a time where innovation is everything. The wealth of nations, the wealth of individuals, the progress of society depends in every way on innovation. Universities and colleges are centers of innovation, yet you would think then if innovation is central, university is central. I mean, isn't that sort of a syllogism? Innovation is central. Universities are places where innovation happens. Therefore, universities are central. I would submit to you that universities today are not central. We are in the middle of the information age or the innovation age. We are centers of information, learning, knowledge, and innovation. And yet, there's all sorts of evidence that we are not central. There is a proliferation of opinion polling done outside of universities, of other kinds of centers. I had a speaker recently who was a very esteemed planetary astronomer who was at MIT, who decided because she had two young children that she'd rather not have to go to campus every day. She now practices planetary astronomy out of her house. She has an optical fiber running into her house. She has a wall-sized display, and she is able to study the Kuiper Belt in her house, presumably in her bathrobe. I mean, that is a remarkable thing. You think about all of the different kinds of think tanks that cluster around Washington or Toronto or London. These are quasi-university places that have people who would have been, back in the day, part of our institutional life. They have decided it is more important for them to be out of the tower and into the body politic, if you will, that they are studying. So there are bits and pieces, flakes, if you will, fragments of our academy that are already, if we look at it, starting to peel off and move out into different sectors of the society. You would think, another contradiction, that how much content is there on the internet? How many of you are really ever stumped anymore? I am just amazed. I will remember a fragment of a quote in an obscure bit of text, and I will put that in my Google search, and I will get the quote in its page context, in its document context, instant. It is an amazing thing. My colleague Ron Yanofsky is an historian. He was asked to do a juried review of somebody's article for a historical journal recently, which he hasn't done for years. He studies a particular person in 19th century America. He said things where he had to, 15 years ago when he got his PhD, fly around the world, literally, to go to archives to study these things. It's all on the internet now. He said, I could have done my PhD dissertation from Berkeley. I didn't have to go to London or to New York or the places. It is a remarkable thing. And yet, you know, I just read that 25% of Americans did not read a single book in the year 2008. This is a remarkable thing. I mean, how can we be having, on one hand, this richness of information, this revolution represented by the internet, and the really serious problems we have with literacy, with numeracy, death of newspapers, perhaps, death of books, although Jeff Bezos here says, no, the book is alive and well. No, but it is remarkable. I mean, you can now have, I bought my wife a Kindle for her birthday, so you can hold 1,500 books in, a 4-ounce package, and 25% of Americans in 2008 did not read a single book. I can't get over that. This one's got to drive us crazy. I mean, we are in a business where technology is always driving forward. So our context, professional context of constant change, constant improvement, constant transformation. I mean, those of us who are my age have lived through at least three revolutions in information technology. We've seen the birth of the network, so the birth of wireless. We're seeing, the age of, embedded intelligence, sensors everywhere. I mean, these are revolutionary changes, and we roll with it. And yet, in general, we haven't seen the sort of concomitant transformation in things like education. There are certainly changes at the margin, but I got to tell you, if a medieval graduate or, of Oxford University were to sort of show up again on our campuses, they would largely recognize a lot of the processes, particularly at commencement. It is true. This one. I mean, so we've got really cool stuff. We have really, I was amazed. I mean, Ted and I traveled for the better part of a year together, and we talked a lot about our sons. And I can remember, I was a biology major as an undergraduate, and you had to take a lot of chemistry, and I liked chemistry, but I have never been good at three-dimensional visualization. And so, yes, I could get through the bonding issue in organic chemistry and sort of write the little sort of tetrahedrons and little bonds, but I never really understood them. So I could, kind of parrot back with the, okay, I remember he drew this thing and put that and this, and yeah, I can sort of figure that. Norma's smiling because she's a chemist. Well, I go into Tony's bedroom one day when he's 10 years old, and he's got some website open where he's got this sort of 3D simulation of chemical bonding. And it's like, in 1 second, I'm able to look at the screen and go, oh, that's what it looks like. I mean, so, pick your example. You've all got your favorite examples about what is the really coolest instructional technology gizmo, widget, whatever you've ever seen, really giving students, giving all of us a leg up on learning. And yet all of the evidence, you know, we have NESI, SESI, we have more assessments of student engagement than you can shake a stick at. And guess what? They all tell you, the UCLA study that's been in, well, you know, in business for 40 years, students are becoming less and less and less engaged. They need to be entertained. You know, it's a little frightening. So you get the idea. There's the, you know, everything's online. You know, there's the open information movement, open source movement, open content movement, open education movement. And yet at the same time, there is a countervailing move by the motion picture industry, the recording industry, the publishing industry to lock things down. It's another one of the great contradictions of our time. But along with these contradictions, there's, you know, incredible possibilities. I mean, I can't say enough good, and you are closer to this and probably have made it happen, about what's happened to the very nature of research as a result of information, information networks, computation. It's just extraordinary. I mean, the National Science Foundation has issued reports that saying that computation and communication is now the, you know, third leg along with theory and experimentation on which the stool of science rests. I mean, there's all this eloquent language about it, but it is just absolutely unbelievable. And again, my friend Ron and I, both trained as historians, sit there and go, you know, as a wannabe historian 100 years ago when I was a graduate student, you spent most of your time in what I call the busyness of scholarship. And that is, you know, you were involved in the hunt. And that was part of the appeal. I mean, it was detective work. I mean, it's like, there's a document in the archives in Lower Slobovia. I will follow that. You know, and that would account for probably if you had a pie chart that said how I, historian, spend my time, you know, finding stuff and sifting stuff. And I was in the modern era where you had index cards that had little dots around there so that you could actually sort your cards like a Hollerith card by person or by date or whatever. But imagine how primitive and how slow. Imagine, you know, genotyping and things like this. That now, imagine protein design, drug design, where you're just doing iteration after iteration, you know, at blinding computational speed. I mean, this is just absolutely revolutionary. And the open information, open courseware, open learning movement is also remarkable. I mean, there's something very seriously there in the realm of possibilities. So I think there's tremendous contradictions that we need to come to terms with, that we as technologists actually need to put on the table for our academic leadership, but there's also these amazing and in some ways surprising results. And we need to study the surprises in order to best understand how to draw those surprises, I think, into those areas where there remain contradictions. So my pitch to you, and that's where this leads me, is to say that your role as information technologist is, I think, enlarging. On one hand, you've still got all the burdens of technical leadership, of architecture, of change management, of change agency that you always had. But I think now you have the added burden of comprehension and of drawing the comprehension about the capacity of information technology's evolution to perhaps precipitate a transformation or revolution in the academy. You need to be the person at the senior table that makes that understood. And I think the best way to make that understandable is through metaphor. So my challenge to you, or my question to you, is for our cloudy future, what is the metaphor of choice that you will help your institution choose? And that can be metaphor or metaphors. I think that technology is now, I've been kind of known for saying on the stage, it's almost good enough to use. That was a little bit cheeky. it's now actually almost good enough to transform us. And if you were sitting here and this was the National Association of Newspapers, you know, I think we would all be in agreement that we're in the process of being transformed. So the question for us is, can we engage our leadership at our institutions in rethinking about if we're not going to be a newspaper? In fact, the National Newspaper Association took the word paper out of their name. They're now the National News Association. I mean, how long are we going to be talking about campus? I mean, what is the role of place? I mean, I'm not suggesting to you that for very many of us, that role changes completely. But I would similarly not kid you by saying I don't think it's going to change at all. So the question is, as you now begin to think of where virtualization can take us, where the cloud can take us, where the movement of the locus of service provision can take us happens, what are we left with? What do we want? What do we choose to be left with? How do we organize around what we choose to be left with? My personal favorite is the School of Athens. You know, if it's like, where do you want to go to college? I want to go to college with Plato. I mean, that's a very historian's kind of view. Now, maybe you would prefer, you know, Descartes, or you would prefer whomever. This is my colleague Ron's fantasy. The Log College, there's a famous, I think it's a Mark Twain quote, but, you know, I never learned more than I learned sitting on a log with somebody smart. So Ron wants to sit on a log with somebody smart and have a great conversation. Maybe that's your learning model. There's this one. I mean, there's an amazing, amazing story about 2 years ago at Oxford University. We've heard of that. It's a famous university, one of the first five. Great university. They were going to require, this was the debate on the table, their students to sign a contract, and that contract said, I will attend lectures and tutorials. It's pretty bad when you get to the stage where you've got to contractually bind your customers to use their product. I mean, so, you know, this is one of the darker. So School of Athens and Log College are sort of metaphors that we would find generally pretty agreeable. But the empty university is another metaphor, the sort of lecture hall where nobody comes. I mean, they're really, really debating this in medical education is, you know, what is the role of place? Because, you know, simulations are incredibly robust in medical education. And again, another positive idea. But these metaphors, these visions, these notions of what technology can nearly do all of these things. I mean, this is the OptiPewter. This was a demonstration that went on between University of Melbourne and the University of California at San Diego about a year ago. And pretty remarkable. Gigantic display, absolutely incredibly rich bit streams, obviously live and in person, real time. Most of this stuff exists. Technology really is nearly good enough to transform us. What I'm suggesting to you is that it's the imagination, it's the lack of metaphor that constrains us today, not the technology. There are plenty of technical challenges ahead, and over the next day and a half, I see there's lots and lots of rich stuff on the program for you to wrestle with. But we know how to wrestle with that stuff. We actually have been through this before, and we will get through this. What I worry about is that the technology is now moving much more quickly than the sociology is moving. And I think, again, that it's our responsibility now to become the spokespersons, not for the technology, but for what the technology can lead us to become. So some of the questions that I think that you need to go back to your institutions and kind of be a pain in your chancellor or president's tail. I mean, we are really down to the ideas of what is the idea of the university? And more specifically, what is the idea of this university? You know, what is the metaphor? What are we really trying to do? And what do we really need to do well in order to manifest our intentions? I mean, how many of you honestly in your gut know what your institution needs to do really well to manifest its intentions? And then you use that as your design driver for your information technology environments. And then what is the information infrastructure, architecture, environment, and service offering? And how you, if you will, the service architecture, which is really what the cloud to me suggests, how do you organize that in order to manifest what the intent of the institution is, what the metaphor that the institution is driven by? So do we as technologists have a strategy and an infrastructure to engage and develop talent? As I said, I think that in the next 10 to 15 years, managing talent is going to be, institutions like ours will rise and fall. They always have. I learned more from a couple of University of California presidents than anyone about what it was that constituted success in a university presidency. And Dick Atkinson, who became the president of the University of California and was at the time chancellor at UC San Diego, said to me, I got involved in every hiring and promotion decision at UC San Diego personally, because your university will never get better than its faculty. That was an insight to me. I didn't realize that. And I've come in the 20 years since he said that to believe that it's really, really true. So if that's true, managing talent, you know, we are nothing in universities but aggregators of talent. That's what we do. We bring talent together. That talent attracts other talents, namely talented staff, talented students. And, you know, there's a famous quote by Conant, the 1940s president of Harvard, which basically said the job of the university president is simply to hang a bag of money out there and attract really brilliant people around that and then to get out of the way. I mean, that was this sort of vision. I'm not sure that's entirely wrong. But I do think that increasingly, talent in a context of global competition for talent. We're no longer in a world where, you know, Europe is in ruins, Japan is in ruins, and the United States is in great shape circa 1950. Guess what? The talent of the world came to us. Ladies and gentlemen, that day is over. We're now in a global dogfight for talent. And I believe that we as information technologists could probably collectively, if we said, let's spend this afternoon developing a talent management system, an intelligence system that would allow us, just like, why is it that basketball coaches can scout somebody in sixth grade and follow them over the course of their next 8 to 10 years before they recruit them, and that we somehow can't track a biologist, you know, in sixth grade, or a chemist, or, you know, a physician or an historian? I mean, we could do that. We had the technology and we, you know, we could do that. Now, wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that give our institutions a real competitive advantage? So there's a series of questions here. More questions for us to consider. I don't need to read them to you. But I want you to get excited about it because, again, you know, my excitement is that, you know, for the longest time, technology was still hard. And we didn't have standards and we didn't have ubiquity and we didn't have a level of knowledge in the workforce about how to use it. That's all basically being taken care of. So now the question is, how do we deploy and organize that technology in ways that truly allow our institutions to fulfill their destinies? So I'll summarize by saying that IT has gotten better, so good that it allows us to change things. I've made that point. I think that we can change things profoundly. Remember Martin Tro, though, that technology is that raging torrent, and it not only allows us to change things, but it allows new institutions to change things. And years ago, you may remember Dancing with the Devil. I mean, I still very much look at the for-profit sector. The for-profit sector 15 years ago represented 2% of higher education's total revenues worldwide. It now represents 8%. So higher education is undergoing a transformation, but the question is it going on inside the institutions that we represent, or is it going on outside those institutions at Phoenix, Sylvan, and others? Our challenge is less technical and one more of institutional purpose, adaptability, and will. I really do think that this is the moment for those of us in information technology to sort of assume the mantle of leadership. I think we are the only ones at the moment that really understand what the promise of technology is for our institutions. And I think that there is urgency because the technology has gotten good enough that if we don't do it, somebody else will. It's actually not even that hard. And if you look at a University of Phoenix that's grown from non-existent to 270,000 enrolled students in 20 years, that tells you how not hard it really is. So I think there is urgency, but I think there's a huge amount of promise. So I hope that you'll sort of take the challenge, the contradictions, and the opportunities with you over the next day and a half, and that you will, in fact, use this as an excuse to sort of be a little more audacious, maybe, than we as information technologists have allowed ourselves to be over the past 20 years. Thanks, everybody.
Richard Katz, with a speech from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Enterprise Information and Technology Conference. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.